Tonight, I want to continue talking about that sixth sense, that or mind, that we've been talking about for the last couple days, in talking about thinking and in talking about the hindrances last night. So as we talk about these mental events that I'm going to talk about, or sometimes we refer to them as the mental landscape, thoughts, memories, emotions, it's important to understand first why there's so much emphasis put on being mindful of the body. And the reason, one of the many reasons is that thoughts and memories and emotions are very nebulous. They don't have any kind of material substance. So we need to approach them by first being very, very solidly grounded in our bodies. If we sat down here the first day and we said, try to be mindful of thinking, it would be really hard to do without first grounding yourself with the breath and being in your body. So as many of you have seen throughout the retreat, we tend to be very identified with what's going on in our minds. And it's really not easy to slow down enough to be mindful of a thought or an emotion. A thought rises, and before we even know it, you know, we're lost in a narrative. Thought, story, it just, you know, starts proliferating. When I was on a retreat some years ago, I was having just pounding thoughts, and it was just relentless, and I just couldn't focus. And so I went to my teacher, who at that time was Sharon Salzberg, and she gave me some very simple, classical Buddhist advice. She quoted this phrase that said, if you want to cross a great water, then you first have to build a great vessel. If you want to cross a great water, then you first have to build a great vessel. In other words, in order to learn to be mindful of our thoughts, we first need to be grounded thoroughly in that great vessel, which is the breath. So when we talk about thought, we're really talking about a very intangible experience. We see the results of thoughts all the time, don't we? In actions. But have you ever seen a thought? Have you ever touched a thought? No. They're completely nebulous and intangible. In mythology, there's a really beautiful image that is used for thought. And sometimes in Native American mythology, it's referred to as Thought Woman or Spider Woman. You can actually go up to Utah and see these beautiful petroglyphs that have the whole creation myths on it. And then way up in the corner, there's this tiny little spider, because the great creatrix is the Thought Woman or the Spider Woman. And one of the reasons that they picked the spider to be this wonderful creatrix is because the spider doesn't live on the earth, it doesn't live in the air, and it doesn't live in water. So in other words, it's really somewhere out there in indefinite space, which is exactly like a thought. It's a very humble little creature. But nonetheless, when it starts to spin and weave, it creates these huge, gigantic, very intricate webs. And so it's seen as this creator, because all of this, everything, it's all being created with our thoughts. Our thoughts are kind of like that. They don't have any inherent substance, and that they're powerful. They're very powerful, and we identify with them, and we believe that our thoughts are true, and we create these huge narratives and these huge autobiographies, all out of our thoughts. So we do tend to be really identified with our thoughts. First of all, because they appear to be ours, don't they? After all, we're thinking them. So who else would they belong to? And secondly, like most humans, almost all of our thoughts tend to be about us. So we're thinking them and they're about us. So it's kind of double whammy. Well, of course. There's no doubt about it. It's mine and it's about me. So it's got to be true, right? Anyhow, that's the way we perceive it. Why else wouldn't it be true? So they seem like they're mine, and we're self-absorbed, and most of them are about us, and so they're true. But what is really important to note about thoughts, and this is really important, that thoughts are not facts. As soon as we have a thought, we immediately assume that it's true because we had that thought. But thoughts are not facts. They can be used critically and analytically to arrive at facts. But in and of themselves, they're not facts. And this is really especially true of the thoughts that we have about ourselves. If you, at this retreat, randomly were to tune in to the person on the other side of the room, and you could just see all of their thoughts floating by, would you think they were facts? I mean, we know what's been going on in our own heads, right? So would you think anybody else's thoughts would be more factual than your thoughts? The sad part is that most of it is not very interesting, is it? But these, you know, obsessive things that go over and over and over. Early on in my practice, I used to do this little exercise that I created about thoughts about myself. And I would do this over a period of a few days. And this was, you know, when I saw my thoughts getting kind of strange, I would start this exercise. And what I would do is I'd get up in the morning, brush my teeth, comb my hair, and I'd look in the mirror. And then I would try to notice the first thought that I had about myself. And some days it was, ah, what a great day, you look great today. And then other days it would be, ooh. And then as the day went on, I would just kind of notice what thoughts I had about myself. And they would range anywhere from, you can't do anything right, to, you know, you really did okay today, you know, you kind of aced that one. Or, you look terrible, you look good. All of these different thoughts about myself. And then I would kind of sit down after a few days and I would assess all of the thoughts. And I'd say, okay, which one's true? Which one is really me? And it became so obvious that we have such a huge range of thoughts about ourselves that we really can't trust any of them to be accurate, especially when we're thinking about ourselves, especially when we're trying to assess who we are and assess and engage in judgments about ourselves. It just isn't very accurate. So these judgments that we have about ourselves that go on and on and on really don't have a whole lot of validity in the outside world. It really helps to ask your friends. We're not great judges of ourselves. We're way too close to the situation. And I think I could go further and say that if our thoughts about ourselves are extremely negative or extremely inflated, we can be absolutely sure that they're not correct. So we can learn through mindfulness to just allow our thoughts to be there, like we started doing today, instead of trying to analyze them or get rid of them. We don't really have to give them some kind of power that they don't have. When you look at the results of human thoughts throughout history, you know, somebody had a thought, and the next thing you know, there was a war. The next thing you know, that there was a continent conquered. There was a book written. There were inventions created. Fortunes were acquired. Fortunes were lost, all because somebody had a thought and acted on it. So this is really important. What thoughts should we carry through? If we tried to act on all these thoughts that we have going on through our heads, we'd really be in trouble, wouldn't we? So it's not learning to get rid of the thoughts. It's really learning to be selective about the thoughts that we want to engage in. And the important thing is to be mindful of our thoughts and see that that's all they are. They're just these mental events that are floating through our heads. It's important to see that there's really a difference between having a thought and engaging a thought. We have lots of thoughts all the time. As I said this morning, once we acquire speech, we have these concepts that are just floating through our head. So which thoughts do we want to engage? And even more important, which thoughts do we want to act on? And so how can we determine that? So we can learn to start noting thoughts, just like we note the breath or body sensations or hindrances. There's a thought about the future. There's an angry thought. There's a thought about the past. There's a thought about myself. There's a judgment. There's running commentary going again. There's that same old story. And we can kind of be playful with it in our practice. We can learn to start to see these repetitive thoughts going through our heads all the time. You know, we can be playful. Oh, there's the drill sergeant again. Or play it again, Sam. Or, you know, there's the taskmaster. Or there's that judging person again. And so we can learn to be kind of loose and easy about it and not take it too seriously. So when we start to learn to notice what kind of thoughts we're having, like we were talking about this morning, it's really, really interesting to catch a thought right in the middle and then watch it dissolve. Because what that does, it gives us this incredible sense of freedom to know that these events that have so much power over our lives are nothing but little puffballs that literally dissolve into nothingness. They have no substance at all. So this is a wonderful kind of freedom to see that these are just mental events. They just disappear into nothing. So we can choose to engage the thoughts that are useful and helpful, and we can learn to act on thoughts that will be helpful in our life. We might think of our minds something like a four-story house. And we might think of the first floor as the level of sensation that we started with in the retreat, that we talk about as our most basic, most authentic, felt sense of our experience that we have. That's all these senses that are coming from inside our body that we're receiving from the outside world. This, we might think of this kind of as the first floor of a house. And then we might think of the second floor as this feeling tone that we've talked about. don't know if everybody, we talked about it in some of the groups, and I know Peter talked about it on, I think, some of the walks. And that is the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So this, we might think of this kind of as the second story in the house as we're moving up this ladder of experience. Then there's the third floor of the house, which is the floor of perception. And this feeling tone and the perception are, come really close together. And perception is kind of what our minds know about the information that it receives from the senses and the brain. So we receive information from our senses and from our brain, and then we start putting it into categories based on past information. For instance, I look outside the window and I see a big green blob, right? And my mind does this thing just in a nanosecond, very, very quickly, and it runs through my memory like this, and it goes, when's the last time I saw a big green blob? Well, it was a tree. So that's our perception tells us this is a tree. So we're kind of going up to the next floor, and we're going up to where it's a little less reliable because you can see that there's a lot of possibility for error there, right? Because the big green blob may not be a tree. It may be something else. And that's kind of how perception works. And then finally, there's the fourth floor of the house, which is this thinking and talking part of the mind. And this is the sixth sense. And this is the part of our mind that has this critical ability to assess things, to solve problems, to synthesize. But it's really, it's also the part that really can go off on autopilot, and it can spin our perceptions into dramas. It can go off and become very obsessive and get caught in narratives and stories. And it's often not very interesting, right? It's that part that really kind of spins. So we could say that the first floor of the house, which is our sensations, our close felt first-hand experience, is really the place that we want to come back down to most often. And what mindfulness does is it helps us to return. We can kind of meet our experience at any one of these floors and then return back down to this first floor, which is what we've been saying throughout the retreat. Drop back into your body. Drop back into your most deeply experienced, first-hand felt experience. So that's why there's so much emphasis on the body and being with our five senses. So no matter what the mind is lost in, thinking or planning, emotions or memories, all it has to do is really drop back to that first floor, back into the body, and really try to experience what's really going on. Because as we go up those floors, it becomes less and less and less reliable. So in our formal sitting practice or in our daily lives, we can choose to engage those thoughts that are wholesome, and to acknowledge that the others are there. We're not trying to repress them. Just acknowledge, you know, there's an unwholesome thought, and just let them go. And then we can take those thoughts that are helpful and learn to engage those. This is from Henry David Thoreau. He says, as a single footstep will not make a path on the earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. To make a deep physical path we walk again and again. To make a deep mental path, we must think over and over the kinds of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives. So those would be thoughts of caring and generosity, loving kindness. These are the kinds of thoughts that we can learn to follow through on. These are the kind of thoughts we can learn to engage and just kind of let the others go. And this is from one of the Buddhist texts. It says, "The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit. And the habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings." So our thoughts, even though they're nebulous, they really have a lot of power, because these thoughts that we choose to engage every day do become habits, and the habits do harden into character. So we're starting to learn to be aware of some of these thought patterns that we have, that we're engaging in our lives. So now I want to go on and talk about the next of the mental events, and that's memory. There's lots of kinds of memories. You know, there's very simple memories, like you need to remember how to get back to your casita, hopefully. You need to remember when to show up, what's on the schedule. But then there's other kinds of memories that might be termed emotional memories. And these are the memories that are a lot more captivating. When scientists started doing all of these interesting brain studies that they're doing now, they started to look at memory, and they thought, wow, we have all this equipment. Now we can really see where all this stuff is stored and how people keep all of these memories in this little tiny orb between the ears. So maybe we'll see all these kind of, where all these little minute details are stored in the brain. But they were very surprised by what they found. They found that what makes a memory is far more simple than storing a whole event in our heads. They found that only the key features of a past event are stored in the mind, not every single detail. We don't our brains would explode if we stored every single detail of our lives in our brains. There wouldn't be any space to put anything new in there. So with memories, what happens is the brain calls up the key features of an event. There's some kind of a trigger. Sometimes they call them flashpoints. Or there's a lot of senses that are particularly connected with memory, like the sense of smell. We smell something, and smell can really trigger memory very quickly. Or sound can trigger a memory very, very quickly. And so there are these kind of flashpoints. And then what happens is, at the moment, all of the other parts of the event are kind of sketched in. And each time we have a memory, it comes up a little bit different. Because what we're doing is we're kind of sketching in everything between all of these key features. And this happens with such lightning speed that we don't even notice it. That memories are arising, you know, we're throwing in all this stuff that's coming up, and then they go back down into our brain and come up a little bit differently each time. So when you think about it, this word to remember is really a pretty apt word. It's been around for a long time, but it really describes what goes on in our minds. We actually re-member each time one of these events comes up. This is from the psychologist Peter Levine. He says, rather than recording a linear sequence of events, memory is more like playing with Mr. Potato Head. Depending on how it feels at the time, the mind selects from colors, images, sounds, smells, interpretations, and responses with similar arousal and feeling tones, then brings them into the foreground in various combinations to produce what we call memory. And this is really important because it makes emotional memories a little bit different than just a thought about the past. And I guess what comes to mind is that this makes memory not terribly reliable because it's happening a little bit different. It's imaged a little bit differently each time it happens. But the basic emotional tone is there. The details just kind of get filled in a little bit differently. But like with a thought, a memory really has no inherent substance. It's totally ephemeral. And yet, look at the power that a memory has. You know, they can make us sad. They can make us weep. They can make us angry. They can make us happy, joyful, lonely. And they can trigger very, very powerful emotions. Emotions and memory are very, very closely linked. They can trigger emotions. And a lot of this sensual imagery can make it feel like some past event is really being relived right on the spot. And I'm not talking about severe trauma. I'm just talking about normal everyday things. Things can feel in memory like they're being relived. And they can really kind of suck us into past events that are long gone from our lives. A friend shared with me this experience about memory that she had at a retreat. She was sitting a six-week retreat at the Insight Meditation Society, and she was just flooded with all of these memories. That was the theme of the whole retreat, just one memory after another coming up. And so she went to her teacher, and her teacher said, every time a memory comes up, just make a soft mental note, memory being known. That's all you have to do, just memory being known. And she started to do this. And as she started to do it, it became extremely painful for her. And she was really confused because the memories themselves didn't really have a lot of painful content. They were just memories about past events. So as the retreat went on, she started to really understand where the pain was coming from. And she started to realize that there was this kind of low level of delusion around memory. This delusion that we can actually live in the past, that we can actually relive and be sucked into past events. And so the pain was realizing that the past is over. A memory is only a memory. It can't take us back there. We can't really live in that space. So it can have a strong feeling like you're right there participating in some past event. But as we know, the past is gone and the future hasn't happened. So it's just acknowledging with a great deal of mindfulness, just memory being known. That's all we have to do. We don't have to get involved in it. We don't have to create a drama around it because that's all it is. It's a mental event, just like a thought. It's a specific kind of thought about the past. This is from the Buddha. He said, not reviving the past, and not hoping to be in the future. Instead, with insight, see each arising state, not reviving the past and not hoping to be in the future. Instead, with each insight, see each arising state. So how can we deal with strong memories when they arise? And they do. How can we deal with them without becoming completely lost in them? Just simply greet them in the same way we would greet a physical sensation. Just name it. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge that a memory is a memory. You know, it's really simple for me to say that, but sometimes it's really hard to do because memories can be so powerful and intense. And they can really, really pull us in. So just to look at it, just like the hindrances, look it in the eye and say, this is a memory. And that's all it is. So again, it's really not the content that's important. It's just knowing that a memory is a memory. It's a sad memory being known. It's a painful memory being known. It's a pleasant memory being known. Just be mindful of it. And know that what the difference is between being mindful of a memory and being lost in a memory. You know, when we're kind of drifting off and just one memory is coming after another and there's this kind of reverie going on, all we're doing is remembering. But when we bring mindfulness to it, it really changes it again. It becomes mindfulness. For instance, if we're remembering our kindergarten teacher, that's a memory. But when we're aware that we're remembering our kindergarten teacher, that's mindfulness. It changes to mindfulness just by bringing awareness to it. Doesn't change the memory, but it really changes the nature of what we're engaged in. So the practice is really not trying to evaluate the content of a memory or figure out, you know, what the flashpoints are or what the imaginary material that has been added is. It's just about being mindful that a memory has arisen. That this is maybe a little different than an emotion, that it's a little different than a thought, that it's a memory, and that's what it is. So now on to the next of what I want to talk about in what we would consider the mental landscape, and that's emotion. And we've talked some about emotion already. But what I really find interesting is the word emotion. It's kind of a funny word, isn't it, for these things that are going on in our minds and bodies? Where did that come from? So when I started to get really interested in being mindful of emotions, I looked that word up to see where it came from. And the word actually means something that sets the mind in motion. And that it's very descriptive of what goes on with an emotion. You know, we can have thoughts that are very enticing and intriguing, or we can have memories that are very compelling, but emotions are something else. They're really out there spinning us around. They can take us in several directions at once. They can be very confusing at times because there is so much internal motion going on in our minds. And emotions can come slowly or they can come in huge bursts. But one thing that is pretty certain is they're very polarized. We don't really have blah emotions too often, do we? We have blah experiences, but we don't have blah emotions. You know, there's love and there's hate and there's fear and there's joy. They're very kind of polarized experience. The psychologist Carl Jung, has everybody heard of Carl Jung? He said once, "Do we have emotions or do emotions have us?" And I think they have us, don't they? I'm not sure that we have emotions. I think emotions have us. And in the teachings, we've been talking a lot about emotions, but the teachings don't really mention emotions, which is kind of interesting. There is no equivalent word in any of the text for emotions. Instead, they talk about mind states. When we talked about the hindrances, we were talking about mind states. But when we're in the grip of an emotion, this academic difference doesn't really make any sense, does it? It's just, it is what it is, and who cares whether it's an emotion or a mind state? It's there. But I think there's kind of a clue to the nature of emotions in the Buddhist word for a mind state, and that's that they're states. They're not personal. They're just passing events. And this is true for memories and thoughts as well. They're just states that are coming and going. And it's hard to really grasp that when we're caught in the grip of an emotion. But as we start to really experience it, just like a thought, and are willing to stay with it, we can see it dissolve in the same way that a thought dissolves. And so, like I talked about last night with the hindrances, sometimes it's really helpful to note these when they arise in a very impersonal way. It's a small thing, but I know in my own practice, it really has made a huge difference to be able to say, there's happiness arising. There's sadness arising. There's joy arising. There's grief arising, because it takes it out of this sense that I'm attached to it and I have to do something about it. Because usually there's not a whole lot you can do about it. It just has to kind of move through. This morning when we gave the instruction about working with thoughts, I said that they do have, if you really look at them, they have kind of usually a slight physical component in our bodies. But an emotion will have a very strong physical component, usually. Not always, but almost always. It will have a very strong physical component. So an emotion involves thought. And often relentlessly spinning thoughts in our heads. Stories, narratives, sometimes obsessive thoughts combined with very strong physical sensations. And sometimes very strong imagery. Those three things together. I like this definition of emotion. I think I might have even gotten it out of the dictionary. It says, a moving of the mind, excitement of feelings, whether pleasing or painful, disturbance or agitation of the mind caused by a specific exciting cause and manifested by some sensible effect on the body. It's pretty descriptive, not very poetic, but fairly descriptive of what goes on with an emotion, that there's all of this mental and physical excitement. And at the same time, not a whole lot of neutral ground. They're either positive or negative. A good example might be to talk about fear. What happens in the mind and in the body when there's fear? Well, first of all, fear is always something that hasn't happened yet. When we're in the midst of a very difficult, scary situation, it's not fear that comes up. It's the fight, flight, freeze reaction. So fear is an imaginary future that has been created. It's a thought or a story about what could happen in the future. And it's not just a thought about what could happen in the future. It is a thought about the worst possible scenario that the mind can conjure up. So it's really a narrowing, what we talked about last night with aversion, it's a narrowing of possibilities when we're afraid. We really kind of shut down and all of the broader possibilities of a situation disappear, and we get down to just the worst possible outcome. Then there's also a physical component at the same time. At the same time that the mind starts to imagine the worst possible outcome, the heart starts beating, there's often heat in the body, there may be pressure in the chest, there may be lightheadedness, and this is all combines to make this emotion that we call fear. And the more that the body feels, the more the mind races. And the more the mind races, the more the body feels. And it just is kind of this snowball effect with fear, is the mind and the body start feeding each other in kind of a negative way. And it's the same with other negative emotions as well, with anger or with desire. But with mindfulness, it's possible to stop and just name the experience. This is fear. And then to start to investigate it. What are the thoughts connected with fear? What's my mind doing? What are these thoughts telling me? And then to start to explore the experience in the body, first by dropping, like we've been talking about, into physical sensations. There's heat in the body. There's pressure in the chest. This is dropping back into that ground floor that I talked about, where most of our deep felt experience happens. So what are the thoughts and what are the stories that we're creating around the thoughts? So basically when a really difficult emotion arises, at first all we can do is name it. Just, there's anxiety, there's fear. And as soon as we name it, we get a little bit of distance from it and we're able to start deconstructing it a little bit into its physical and mental components. Looking at the sensations in the body and looking at the narrative that the mind starts spinning, such as, I'm never going to get over this, things always turn out the same, my life is boring. All these narratives that we start spinning around just a physical sensation and a thought. And pretty soon we're off and running. So sometimes it's just interesting to note it over and over and over again until it starts to dissipate. Just let it completely crumble in front of you. And sometimes you can spend a whole sitting doing that. Anger, 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 anger. It takes a lot of patience. But pretty soon, anything in the world changes over a period of time. Everything is impermanent. Everything comes and goes. Everything has a beginning, a transitional period, and an end. And eventually we can see that these strong mental events, whether they're an emotion or a memory, happy memory, sad memory, painful memory, or whether they're a thought, they just come and go. And so we don't really have to get hooked on them. They don't really have a lot of substance in and of themselves. So I'll just go very quickly over the rain again, just as a little review on how to work with these. R is to recognize what's going on. Name it. A is to accept it. Don't push it away. This is actually happening. Allow it to happen. I, to investigate it, to look at the thoughts that are connected with the experience, to look at the physical sensations, and then N, again, is non-identification. It's not my anger or my fear. It's just fear. That's all it is. It's just anger. This is from a Tibetan mystic. He said, "I'm not really impressed by someone who can turn the floor into the ceiling or fire into water. A real miracle is someone who can liberate just one negative emotion." It's huge. It's huge to be able to liberate one negative emotion. So let's just sit for a few minutes.